Thank you very much. I'm going to try and do this in just under 30 minutes because I'm most interested in what you've got to say to me. I gave you the title of How Will Our Children Afford Housing because I've done enough of these to have a fairly good prediction of the average age of the audience. I have kids, I suspect many of you have kids. Also, quite often, most of my audience are fairly well housed themselves. So it's not about us, it's about the next generation to come and what's going to happen to them. I'm going to go through these slides quite quickly because they're really a comfort blanket for me. Most of the maps and graphs and so on are actually in the book if you're interested, but I can always go back to one later. They just force me to have some structure to what I'm talking about. I'm a geographer, so I have to show you some maps. These are some strange maps in an atlas that's coming out later this month about Europe, which stretch Europe and stretch Britain so that everywhere's equal to the number of people it has. So we're just about up here, just on the top of London in population terms. And housing's really about fitting people in. And the part of the debate you never hear on housing, you don't hear very much about, is that politicians often say we need to build hundreds of thousands of more homes. And at the same time, they say we're going to have zero net migration, in which case, who are you actually building the thousands of more homes for? And I might come back to that at the end. I think we've just reached a milestone in terms of British housing history, in that this year, London may have surpassed Tokyo as becoming the most expensive large city in the entire planet to live in. And London has a disadvantage compared to Tokyo. Tokyo has a very equal income distribution, so people in the middle are fairly well off. They have one of the poorest set of rich people on the planet. They're still rich, but they have the least. And so people in Tokyo find it easier to afford housing than the average person does in London or on the edges of London. And we're currently seeing a housing boom, a housing bubble, as I'll show you in a minute, based on the idea that somebody will be able to buy these houses at this price in the future, and somehow some of our children might be able to do it. And I think this is getting untenable that that'll be what happens. Here's a different kind of map. It's the cities of the United Kingdom, each drawn to be proportional to how much housing, residential housing, is worth. Or I should say was worth just over a year ago, because housing in London's gone up by 100 billion in value in the last year. I had a figure of London prices rising by 17% according to the Land Registry in the last year. I've just read in the paper yesterday that it's 19% in a year. That's a housing bubble. That's, if you look at past bubbles, that kind of slope. And also the acceleration is what a bubble looks like. Just going to show you a map of London. I want you to memorise those colours. Okay?
Yes.
32 colours, easily done. Okay, you've memorised the colours. Now I'm going to show you the same map, but this is the same as those bubbles earlier. That's London shaped by the value of housing. You'll see how much the middle's worth. This is the London shaped by dwellings. There are more dwellings in the middle of London. But more dramatic is here. This is England, where we've made every part of England, each region and each borough of London, the size of the increase in housing value in the last year. So London as a whole has increased in value by more than the whole of Yorkshire, Humber, North East and North West, and particular parts of London are rising more than that. That's a bubble. It looks like a bubble. You draw a map of it, it's a bubble. Just because it's a bubble doesn't mean you know when it's going to pop. I wish I should have brought a whole set of balloons and we could all give you balloons, you could all blow them up and we'll see when your balloons pop. But you don't get a pop without blowing the bubble up in the first place. At the very heart of this, we have the super rich buyers who are coming in. I think these matter. Boris doesn't. He goes on about how it's just 6% of buyers. I think these matter because when you have accelerating prices of many millions in the centre of London, ridiculously high prices in somewhere like Milton Keynes can sound low compared to those millions. It changes the psychology of housing. And there are many things going on at the moment to cause this particular rise. One of which is that the Swiss authorities have come to an agreement with the US authorities to open up all Swiss bank accounts to be investigated by the United States, I think within 12 months of now. So if anybody just happened to have some money in a Swiss bank account that they hadn't paid tax on to the United States, now's the time they need to get that money out. And where do you take that money out? Where's a safe place to put it? You buy somewhere in London. So people are endlessly interested in when will this thing stop. That's one possibility. But it could go on for many years. It could crash next week, and we won't find out about it for another 3 weeks. So say if you buy in a book, which is slightly expensive because it's not out in paperback yet, the publishers are very enthusiastic about the idea that something dramatic is going to happen to the housing market, and they're waiting for that, before they put it in paperback, sadly. The very end of the book was a quote from Karl Marx. They gave me the title, which is a quote from Karl Marx. I didn't choose it. I thought I'd better put that at the end. And on the last day, before it went to the printers, the estate agent Savills produced a report, which the Financial Times printed, which showed that the average mortgage payer in Britain had become poorer in the last 5 years, partly because their mortgages were bigger and house prices had gone down. The average owner-occupier hadn't seen a big increase, but landlords in just 5 years had increased their wealth by 245 billion at a time when the country was becoming poorer. Because what happened with the crash in 2008, the number of transactions on the housing market halved, stayed at half for 2009, half for 2010. People still need to move. They don't buy, so they rent. Rents go up, particularly where the jobs were. And of course, the jobs are concentrated down here. There's even an increase in public sector jobs down here. So people move towards the jobs, they rent for the jobs, the rents go up, the landlords get more money because the rents go up. And what they do with the money? They buy another house, and another house, and another house. And the house prices go up as well, but that's not a problem for the landlords because they can just put the rents up. It was not a concerted plan. I challenge anybody, I would buy them a bottle of champagne at a medium price to find me evidence of five large landlords meeting in a club in London and deciding to do this. It was too sudden and it happened too quick, but it's happened and it's accelerating at the moment. So when they talk about putting up interest rates to try to calm the market down, particularly in London, they're forgetting how many people do not buy with a mortgage now in London. It's not just the investors who can buy in cash, it's landlords who are buying in cash. So increasing interest rates would have the effect of reducing the purchasing power of families who might want to buy. The underlying story of this book is all about inequality. We've had rising income inequality since the very late 1970s, early 1980s. Wages at the top would be going up faster, wages in the middle were going up less. Last 4 years they've actually gone down, but until then they were going up. Bottom end wages went up the least. There was a little jump in the minimum wage, which wasn't great. And of course benefits have gone down relatively compared to average earnings. So we've become stretched apart in how much income we have. You get a lag effect, but eventually that results in growing wealth inequalities and problems for housing. Because you have a small group at the top who can buy more than one house, or three houses or four houses, and you have a growing group in the middle who can no longer afford a mortgage. So the number of people buying their houses has been going down since the 1990s. This is a very old cartoon in the Plebs Journal from the 1930s. And I want to mainly talk about what happened since 2008. Back in the 1930s, after the crash in 1929, the idea was that you all stepped down a rung and we were all in it together. And the complaint then was that if you're at the bottom of the ladder, that wasn't much fun. And if you want a really simple explanation about why you're getting food banks now, is because if you're in the bottom of the ladder and you step down, you either pay the rent or food, but you can't do both. The interesting thing is what's happened to the top 10%. The top 10%, for most of all of the last 100 years, have travelled with the top 1%. As the 1% got poorer, which they did from 1913 all the way through to the 70s, the 10% got relatively poorer. For the late 70s onwards, the 1% got progressively richer, very, very rich. You now need 160,000 to just make it in as a household into the top 1%. But the rest of the top 10% went with them from the 70s. I'll try not to give you too many numbers, but it's hard to talk about these things without numbers. In 1979, what I call the 9%, the group just above the top 1%, had 2.5 times average income. By 1990, they had 3 times. So they were better off. And they tended to vote for the government, which was a Conservative government, which was involved in that inequality rising. What's fascinating is that since 2008, that group have become slightly poorer. The 9% have not benefited from that top tax rate cut because they weren't getting enough of it. They've lost their child benefit. They haven't seen salary increases because there's been some austerity at the top. And so the Institute of Fiscal Studies has shown that 99% of us are now more equal than we were. In fact, inequality amongst the 99% has now gone back to 1990 levels. But the 1% have carried on going up. HMRC says that last year was the biggest increase in the average taxable to declared income of the best off 1%. And that's completely new for British politics. You can run a country if you've got the 10% on your side. How you do it when you have a small group heading away and that other group feeling pinched. Squeeze middle is all about the 9% in a way. There's the income distribution from the IFS. If you have got very good eyesight and want to work out where you are, you are average if your household is bringing in £442 a week before tax and you've got no children. If you've got children, you need a little bit more than that. Up here to be in the 1%, it's £3,000 a week, and again, that's with no children. That's our distribution at the bottom. That gap between the two lines is the reliance on benefits. And this is the tax take up here, which in effect pays for those benefits. That's our society. That's the kind of inequality we have. We're unusual. The statistics for the top 1% are all you need to measure how unusual we are. They correlate very highly with other measures of inequality. The most unusual rich country in the world is the United States, where the top 1% now take 20% of all income. This is what exercises Thomas Piketty the most. After that, it's us. Our top 1% take 15% before tax. The most equal country in Europe is the Netherlands, where they're around 6%. Almost 3 times cheaper, top 1% in the Netherlands. In Switzerland, they cost half as much as us, which basically means that bankers in Switzerland are paid half as much as British bankers. They don't all come to London to work. There are these very big differences. We end up with very high wealth inequalities as a result. This is one estimate of the distribution of unequal wealth in the country. And when you look at that, you almost inevitably have a problem with housing, because how are this group of people supposed to house themselves where they don't have the resources to be able to do it? So what you end up doing is heading back to a society which is all about renting. This group of people holding all this much of the wealth will hold property in future, and they will supplement their incomes through the rental incomes of our children. That's where we are currently heading, back to a time in the past where you talk about your ownings of capital and your ownings of land, because that would say whether you were the kind of family who were respectable. Did you have enough income? Piketty goes on about Jane Austen novels. And the question is, what's in your estate? Now, the model you're told is get in on this for yourself. If you can get 2, 3, or 4 properties and you can get a rental income, you can be part of this, you'll have a nice pension, and maybe you can pass them on to your children. The innumeracy of this is that only a very small minority can do this. We can't all be each other's landlords. But at the moment, you can sell the idea that you can be each other's landlords to a population, particularly if they're optimistic, if a population is aspirational. Or you can even head towards American-style rates of inequality, where a large number of the population will say this is good, even amongst the poorest, will say this is the only way things can be. Some people are strivers, they're economically successful, they deserve to have it. We're lucky we can rent from them. I can be sceptical about it because we can partly remember what it was like to be in that past. In that past, the majority of jobs for women were, the largest occupational group for women was working in service. That's why we have a residual dislike of the idea of heading back towards there. Just a few more images about how unusual we are. And we're becoming rapidly more unusual. And this is often presented, these statistics about the very rich, as this is beneficial. The wealth will trickle down, they create jobs, and so on. The argument against that is we've never had such high rates of youth poverty as St. Thomas billionaires have had so much money. This is a graph from Thomas Piketty. I thought I was ever so clever when I discovered Thomas Piketty's graphs 2 years ago. This is great stuff, I should get it out to the world. Had no idea that he was about to do that himself. Anyway, this is the changing income of the 1% in America going up to way over 20% there. And that's an index of the changes in regulation. So as the 1% became richer, regulations on banks were removed. Piketty claims his relationship between this and the crash. He's been attacked by the Financial Times for getting his figures wrong. It's all about estimates of wealth. And the reason why Piketty, he didn't get his estimates wrong, you just don't know what they are, is because our Office of National Statistics has no idea about the wealth distribution at the top. This is a graph based on data they released by mistake and then retracted. It's too late. It's out. And they retracted it because you really can't work out the full wealth of the 1%. It's too hard to do because so much is hidden. I think I've got just about 3 more graphs for you, so I'll show you these and I'll tell you some of my ideas about what I think should be done, and then I'll hear what you think should be done or how I should think differently. So I'm just going to show you about Switzerland and the Netherlands, but first of all, about how many households with children in England are now privately renting. I'll zoom in on this one. This graph comes from Alan Milburn's Social Mobility Child Poverty Commission. It's official government data. And it says that around about now, a quarter of all households with children in England are renting privately. The point is, it has suddenly zoomed up. We had a small private rented sector. It was too small. Most European countries have a larger one. But we never wanted a private rented sector for families with children, not with our laws, which means that you can have to move on after 2 months. Because children need to stay in the same area, at least for a little bit of time, otherwise they lose all their friends. And then they lose all their friends again, and then they lose all their friends again as they move school. This is what I mean about, I do not think this is planned. But it is now a quarter in England, and it's a very, very sudden change. Very, very recent. Part of it may be temporary. You never know, but there's no sign at the moment that these families... Because as they've been out of the housing market for these years, the housing market in the areas with jobs has been going up and up. So they're unlikely to suddenly jump back in and buy a house off a landlord to be able to live in. People do things differently in other places. The Netherlands is the average country for one particular inequality ratio. They have far better housing laws than we do. Germany is an example that's always given of a country that's kept its house prices calm, its housing cheap, and its rights for tenants very good, so that private renting for families makes sense because you can't be kicked out and moved on when somebody who can pay a bit more comes along. People are told that all this is inevitable. Everywhere's becoming more unequal. It's a global race. If we don't try hard enough, we won't make it. You're a silly, woolly liberal. What are you talking about? And I get this a lot. To which I put up the graph about the 1% in Switzerland and the Netherlands, two quite successful countries economically. The 1% will always be 1%. There'll never be a bigger group. They'll never be smaller. You're always going to have 1%. They'll always be the richest. But they don't have to have 15% of all income. You can do quite well on much lower proportions. And if they have less, and there are ways of helping them have less, they're not very good at controlling it themselves, because to get into the 1%, it helps if you're a bit acquisitive. If the 1% have less, then they can buy fewer houses and they can not be landlords as much. Only 2% of people in this country are landlords, but 25% of members of parliament are, because of our ridiculous system of housing members of parliament, which we never realised the damage that would be done by creating housing allowances for MPs in the 80s to help them buy housing in London. MPs are not particularly interested in housing because they don't personally experience the problems. The fastest way to get MPs interested in housing would be to get rid of their housing allowances this year and to make all new MPs elected in May 2015 rent privately on the private market in London. If you wanted a radical policy from any party, just ask why they can't do that. And you could put their pay up, and they'd still struggle. This is my last map. This is Switzerland. Country which I say does much better in controlling its best off 1%. Not a particularly radical country. And a country which controls its house prices incredibly, although in ways in which we cannot easily do legally. Unless we become like Switzerland, which we're promised we're going to have a referendum on, depending on how we vote next May. Just some more graphs from Piketty showing you tax rates at the top coming down over time. I've got too many of these and I'm determined not to talk for too much. So let's zoom forward. Attitudes on inequality. To show you this. This is data from Mori for 2013. It's a proportion of people who think that large differences in income and wealth is bad for society overall in different countries, from China to the United States. And you'll see that everywhere, apart from the United States, a majority of people think inequality is bad. This is now fashionable. Obama last year had reducing inequality as one of his top two priorities. The president of China had one of the top two priorities was reducing inequalities in China. The world business leaders who met at Davos, who are not a particularly radical group, came up with 31 priorities for the planet, which is a bit more than, you know, at least Obama and the Chinese Premier just had two. They came up with 31, and the top three were to reduce economic inequality, number one, tackle climate change, interestingly, number two. The two are actually related, but we can talk about that. And thirdly, unemployment. So we're getting a shift in what people worry about again, but it's not sure quite how they're going to do it and what they'll do about it. So these are my suggestions about how we begin to change things. They're just suggestions, they're not a manifesto for say you have to do it all. I think if any one of these was even hinted at, it would be beneficial. But the entire point of this is trying to work out how will our children be housed only to the level of comfort that we have had. It's no longer talking about being housed better in the way that we were. I've been housed much better than my parents were housed. My mum was a middle-class daughter of a school teacher in Leeds. She talks about the ice on the inside of the windows and so on because you didn't have double glazing and that. Okay, we've had this massive, massive improvement in housing. I'm just talking about our children getting the same quality of housing as us. And can we possibly achieve that rather than being stuck in bedsits to their 30s or sharing property or spending 60 or 70% of their income on the mortgage and not sleeping at night in case interest rates rise 0.5%? Some of you can remember interest rates rising a lot more than that. That isn't talked about at all. We need some way of deterring people from thinking they're going to make an absolute fortune by buying housing. the moment, we've got a housing system that rewards you. The more you spend, the safer your money is, and the more it goes up as an asset. It can earn far more than you can earn. Simply taking the council tax system, taking that top band, splitting it in half, taking the top band again, splitting it in half, and so on, means you'd get a progressive taxation system for housing, which at least would help make people think a bit more before they spend 4 million or 6 million or 8 million at the top, and that would have a dampening effect on the whole market. There are much better and fairer property taxes than that, but that's a simple one given the system we've got. Secondly, we have a thing called the right to sell. The right to sell was enacted under the last government, and it's a right that if you find you can't pay the mortgage anymore because you become ill or you split up or you lose your job, you can apply to become a tenant of a housing association or the council, and they buy the property from your bank and you're not evicted. This was brought in because people were very scared of what happened in Greece and Portugal and Spain and Ireland and Iceland, and in fact every other country around the edge of Europe apart from us might happen to us. So how do you avoid mass evictions? We already have it, it's quite well used, it could be extended, and it's a way of coping with not having people evicted. We do need to use the housing we've got better, the empty commercial property better. We need fewer second homes, given how hard it is for many people to house themselves. And deterrence, you see, people should still be able to have a second or third home. I think it just costs them more than it costs them at the moment to do it. This is the graph about there being not too few homes. It's the work of Becky Tunstall. She looked at the census all the way from 1911 to the last census, and at rooms. The last census tells us about bedrooms. And the key graph is the top one there. And it's the ratio of the number of rooms of the best off tenth of people in Britain to the worst off tenth. So if I go back to 1911, the best off tenth of people had four times more rooms per person than the worst off tenth. That's a 4-to-1 ratio, four times more rooms per person of the best off 10 to the worst off 10. And of course, it's got worse to 1921, and then got progressively better and better and better to the heady heights of the 1970s, when we had a 3-to-1 ratio. The best off 10 had three times more rooms per person than the worst off 10. And then we get this. And this is a combination of things. One is rising economic inequality. One might be immigration to London, movement to the rest of the population to London. Another is ageing, which is absolutely wonderful, apart from the fact that we've got a housing system that was built at a time when we tended to die around age 75. And we haven't got a system that allows you to cascade down as you get older. But this is dramatic, this change in the unequal distribution of rooms. The bedroom tax tackles the most efficient part of the housing system, the part where people fit in the best. We have enough bedrooms for everybody to have at least one spare bedroom for visitors. We don't have enough for people to have three or four or five spare necessarily. I wouldn't force people out of their home at all. I would try to increase your rights as a tenant so that renting became attractive to the elderly, and some would choose to do it, to cascade down from their large house into a smaller rented house. And that's a good measure of just how much better you have to make renting and rights for renting. It's got to be good enough for 75 and 80 year olds and 85 year olds. We are going to need some building, particularly in London, places around London. But the main reason we need to build is for people who are going to come. And we don't talk about that at all. We try and have a debate about housing which doesn't touch on immigration. It's a very scary world. We don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we could at least house ourselves well. We have most of the properties we need to do it. Our problem is that we're locked to a way of thinking that says people should only be worried about themselves and their family. And if everybody just worries about themselves and their family and maximises their own economic interests, everything will be okay. And that might work with something, but the problem with housing is it's geographical. It takes up space. And when people who are better at that than others do it, it's to the detriment of the majority of the population. Thank you very much for listening.